Jeff Spittler, May 5th, 2002, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 68. The Killing Times, Part 2. Okay. Let's see. Last week we introduced James Renwick, the new minister of the United Societies, who returned to Scotland in September of 1683. He covered numerous incidents of persecution, which intensified after the Enterkin rescue and the apologetical declaration published in November of 1684. The justiciary courts were formed and were aided in their work by a horde of flies. Okay, those were spies and informers. They were called flies. They were also very numerous, which is probably one of the reasons. The courts were required to execute people they deemed guilty within 6 hours or within 3 hours in certain locales. They threw hundreds, perhaps thousands of people in prison and sent them as slaves to the colonies. Claverhouse fell out of favor. His only chance at rewinning his favor was to do his job better, unfortunately for the Covenanters. And Charles II died somewhat unexpectedly on the 6th of February 1685, and by the account of his brother, died a Roman Catholic, and having left no legitimate male heirs, although he left several illegitimate ones, he was succeeded by his brother James, a Roman Catholic. Okay, Bruce raised an interesting question about what happened to the Covenanters that were transported as slaves to the Carolinas, and I did a little research on this, but I'm sorry to report it's far from conclusive. They're mentioned by, it's Jock Purvis, Fair Sunshine. He says, from whom did the early American slaves wrested from Africa hear the gospel? No doubt from Puritans and Quakers. But such were not fellow slaves. The former lived more in their own settlements, and the latter, to their everlasting credit, would not hold slaves. Whosoever got to a Quaker settlement was at once a free man. To the West Indies, Barbados, and South Carolina, many Covenanters were sent as slaves. The accounts of their tragic hell ships make painful reading. Hundreds of these godly men and women, shipped to be sold as slaves, perished in most terrible conditions through disease, and in fearful storms were drowned miserably battened under hatches. From those who reached the plantations, black slaves heard the gospel, and thus white-skinned slaves and black rejoiced in one common Lord. Skipping a little bit, he says, the Negro spirituals always have a hearing. The words of worship there united with the moving melody are a living union. But such melodies, it seems, may be sought for in vain in the Negro's own native land, Africa. Whence came they? Out of something wondrously new, the dark soul meeting with the light of life, Christ Jesus. Yes, and out of fellowship in his sufferings, and the fellowship of Christ Jesus in the slave sufferings. Yes, no doubt of that, but there are seeming traces of time and melody in these lovely spirituals which are reminiscent of the music of the old metrical psalm singing. Who can say? At any rate, these banished men and women carried the message of redeeming love to their fellow slaves of another race. And I came across another account, but I'll actually get to it later. So, okay, a few days after James II became King of England, he proclaimed himself King of Scotland also by proclamation. Okay? And it claimed that he was righteous king and sovereign over all persons and in all causes, as holding his imperial crown from God alone. He was not, however, crowned in Scotland, and he never took the coronation oath, and that was later held against him at a convenient time. Shortly we will get to further and deeper persecution, but in the meantime we might mention some of the resistance efforts. The Kirkcaldy toll booth or jail was stormed by a band of over 100 men on the 16th of December 1684. That resulted in all the prisoners being freed and one sentry being killed. 2 days later, Claverhouse and his men trying to trail the toll booth stormers caught up with some of the Covenanters at Auchincloy. And one of these was Black McMichael, the duck hunter, Fowler. He is said to have nearly overcome Claverhouse in a sword fight before being killed himself with a blow from behind. When Claverhouse later that day or the next day found out who he had battled with, he had McMichael and some of the other men exhumed from the local churchyard and hung up on a gibbet. Okay, the persecution that heated up in 1685, as many Covenanters were hunted down, and a number were executed, say, on the spot for refusing to take the abjuration oath. There's a book by a guy named Campbell, which I have here, I'll pass around later. He shows a bar chart of executions per month. The trend is clearly upward from January through May, and afterwards then falls precipitously. But he's mostly, what he's plotting are actually really sort of executions in the field, as it were. Because they still continue afterwards with people being sent to the grass market and so on. But these sort of on-the-spot killings went up through May, and then after that fell off to almost nothing for the rest of the year. He puts forth the theory that the government was worried about that the Covenanters would join in this plot with the Earl of Monmouth and Argyll. They were preparing a coup d'etat in the Netherlands. Well, they were preparing in the Netherlands, but they were going to bring it to Great Britain. And according to this theory, when the government realized the Covenanters wouldn't join in the plot because they saw the plotters as malignants and sectaries, the persecution was relaxed some. It's hard to say for sure, or if they just ran out of victims, but the plot itself was discovered. Argyll was captured and executed on the 30th of June, 1685. So almost the same time period, the threat was over. So the Duke of Monmouth landed with a force of about 5,000 men in England on the 6th of July, and he was captured and executed within 9 days. So didn't last long. Okay, there are quite a few martyrdom stories to be told. I won't plan to tell all of them. I'll pick three that happened in the first 2 weeks of May in 1685. They're John Brown of Priesthill, the two Margarets in Wigtown, and Andrew Hislop. And some of these are no doubt familiar to you, maybe all of them. But I doubt if all of them are familiar to everyone, so... I'll start with John Brown of Priesthill, and I'll get to this second. This is the account in the it's in the back of Cloud of Witnesses. It's not actually listed in the table of contents, but it was added by a later editor. He was known in the district as the Christian Carrier. Okay, and a carrier, I looked this up, and if it wasn't very helpful, it was somebody who was either a porter or a mover of goods. Probably not a letter carrier. But he was of more than ordinary piety and knowledge, and possessed unusual skill in communicating to others what he knew. He had never attended the services of the curates, but in other respects had given no offense to the government, yet he found it prudent to hide in the moorlands. His long exemption from molestation had evidently emboldened him to return home when he speedily fell into the hands of the destroyer. On the morning of the 1st of May, 1685, between 5 and 6 o'clock, after he had made worship with his family, he was on the way to cut peats with his spade in his hand, when in the thick mist he was surrounded by Claverhouse and three troops of dragoons on the road from Lesmahega. Whether Claverhouse had any knowledge of his character is not known, but he brought him from the peat ground to his house, a bleak, desolate spot, fully 4 miles to the north of Muirkirk railway station, and from which at the present time not a hut, not even a tree, is to be seen. Here he was examined and gave his answers distinctly and solidly, which made Claverhouse ask his guides through the muir if ever they heard him preach. No, no, was the reply. He was never a preacher. Well, said Claverhouse, if he has never preached, much as he prayed in his time, go to your prayers, he added to John Brown, for you shall immediately die. The carrier prayed with great fervor. Thrice Claverhouse interrupted him. On one of these times, John Brown was pleading that the Lord would spare a remnant and not make a full end in the day of his anger, when Claverhouse said, "I gave you time to pray, and you are begun to preach." John Brown calmly turned round about on his knees and said, "Sir, you know neither the nature of preaching nor praying that call this preaching," and then continued without confusion. When he was ended, Claverhouse said, "Take good night of your wife and children," for she stood by with the child of his former wife clinging to her, one of her own in her arms, and was soon to give birth to another. "Now, Isabel," were his words to her, "the day has come that I told you would come when I spake first to you of marrying me." "Indeed, John," she replied, "I can willingly part with you." "That is all," he said, "I desire. I have no more to do but to die. I have been ready to meet with death for years past." He kissed her and his children. He gave them his blessing and wished, purchased and promised blessings to be multiplied upon them. Claverhouse now ordered 6 of his soldiers to fire on him. But such had been the effect of the martyr's prayers that not even one of these men, long used to deeds of violence, would obey his command. And in a rage, he shot him with his own hand. "What thinkest thou of thy husband now, woman?" was his question to the widow as she gazed on the lifeless body. "I thought ever much good of him, and as much now as ever." "It were but justice," was his reply, "to lay thee beside him." If you were permitted," was her heroic answer, "I doubt not your cruelty would go that length, but how will you answer for this morning's work?" "To man," the murderer replied, "I can be answerable, and as for God, I'll take him into mine own hand." But this was empty bravado, for even on his seared conscience, the dying words of his victim left an impression that he could never wear off. And interestingly enough, the cover of this book, Standing Witnesses, is this painting of John Brown, the execution. So, if you want to see it, I can pass it around. I've got a microphone on, Brad. I can't. I'm not throwing the book. Okay, well, the next day, the two Margarets were martyred. And I think most of you have probably heard this story before, but they were tied to a stake in the river leading to the sea. And this is, I'll pass these around. This is some pictures taken at the stake here. Is the traditional site for this. The river changed course, or they changed the course of the river intentionally, which is why the stake's on dry land. And then this bottom part here is there. Actually, there's two of them. The two Margarets are buried here, and then a third guy, John Milroy George Walker. No. Here lies William, well, whoever he is, another covenanter, so. This is right. Yeah. Okay, so we have a conflict in dates here. This says upon the 11th. Upon the 11th of May, 1685, Margaret Loughlin in the parish of Kirkinner and Margaret Wilson in Glenvernach in the Shire of Galloway, being sentenced to death for their noncompliance with prelacy and refusing to swear the oath of abjuration by the Laird of Leg, i.e. Sir Robert Grierson, Captain Strachan, Colonel Wimram, Mr. David Graham, and Provost Coltrin, i.e. of Wigtown, who commanded them to receive their sentence on their knees, which they refusing were pressed down by force till they received it. And so were by their order tied to a stake within the sea mark in the water of Blednock near Wigtown, where after they had made them wrestle long with the waves, which flowing swelled on them by degrees and had sometimes thrust them under water, and then pulled them out again to see if they would recant, they, enduring death with undaunted courage, yielded up their spirits to God. The former was a widow woman of about 63, of a most Christian and blameless conversation, a pattern of piety and virtue, who, having constantly refused to hear the curates, was much pursued and vexed, and at length taken by the soldiers while she was devoutly worshipping God and her family, and being indicted of being at Bothwell Bridge, Airsmoss, and 20 field conventicles, and as many house conventicles, after sore and long imprisonment, without necessary refreshments of fire, bed, or diet, at length suffered this cruel death. The other, Margaret Wilson, a young woman of scarce 23 years of age, and I think there's different accounts. The one says she's 19 or so. I think it may even say on the tombstone. But after she, with her brother, who was about 19, and her sister, 15 years old, had been long driven from their father's house and exposed to lie in dens and caves of the earth, wandering through the mosses and mountains of Carrick, Nithsdale, and Galloway, going to Wigtown secretly to visit the aforesaid Margaret Loughlin, was taken by the fraud of one Patrick Stewart, who, under color of friendship, having invited her and her sister to drink with him, offered them the king's health, and upon their refusal of it, as not warranted in God's word, and contrary to Christian moderation, went presently out and informed against them. Her sister was dismissed as being but 15 years of age, upon her father's paying £100 sterling for a ransom. She being detained and examined, whether she owned the king as head of the church and would take the abjuration oath, not answering to their pleasure, but adhering to the truths of Christ, was in like manner condemned, and after great severities of imprisonment, suffered the aforesaid death, being put oft into the water, and when half dead, taken up again, to see if she would take the oath, which she refused to her last breath. While her fellow sufferer was wrestling with the waves as being put first in to discourage her, the persecutors asked her what she thought of that sight. She answered, "What do I see but Christ wrestling there?" One of the times that she was taken out of the water, they said, "Say, God save the king." She returning with Christian meekness, "I wish the salvation of all men, but the damnation of none." Upon which one of her friends, alleging she had said what they demanded, desired them to let her go. But they would not, seeing she refused to take the oath. During her imprisonment, she wrote a large letter to her friends, wherein, besides the lively and feeling expressions of her sense of God's love, she doth, with a judgment not usual for age and education, disclose the unlawful nature of the abjuration oath, hearing of curates, owning the king's supremacy, which was the thing of the persecutors meant by his authority, and proves the necessity of her suffering upon these heads. Okay, so it's a very interesting place to visit, Wigtown, and they actually there's several monuments and a museum and so on there. Your speaker today though went. There's also it's a town of bookstores, a book town. So I did some of these things when I went to the bookstores for a while. Okay, and then this account is from Hewison of Andrew Hislop. He was the son of a widow who lived near Gillesby in Hutton Annandale. This kindly widow had sheltered a dying wanderer and, assisted by her sons, buried him by night in the field adjoining her home. News of this reached Sir James Johnston of Westerhall, the steward depute, who caused the corpse to be exhumed for identification and, as a punishment for reset, in other words, harboring fugitives, leveled the widow's cottage, turning her household into wanderers. Claverhouse captured Andrew and brought him, probably on the 10th May, to Westerhall, then at Craighaw, Eskdalemuir. What occurred thereafter is very indefinitely stated by Wadrow, and the reason why Johnstone judged the case is not stated. By the commission given to Drummond on 21st April, all other commissions were rendered void and extinct. And unless Drummond renewed the commission granted to Johnstone concurrently with Douglas, which had expired, then Johnstone had no right to interfere. Where Claverhouse was a precisian, Johnstone was a practical sheriff with the fearless spirit of his tribe in him. Parliament had just set its seal upon the sanguinary policy of King and Council and passed the Act of 8th May, condemning preachers and hearers at conventicles to death and confiscation. Johnstone ordered the execution of Hislop on 11th May, and Claverhouse, now reduced to a mere executioner, was, despite his protest, forced to obey. Wadra declares that Claverhouse desired the commander of the Highland Infantry to carry out the order, but that more righteous officer drew his men off and swore he would fight Claverhouse and Dragoons before he did it. Protesting, "The blood of this poor man may be upon you, Westerhall, I'm free of it," Claverhouse ordered his troopers to shoot Hislop. The peasant lad, refusing to be blindfolded, stood, Bible in hand, facing his three executioners, whom he adjured that they would answer for their crime at the great day. After prayer and the singing of some verses of the 118th Psalm, another fearless believer won the martyr's crown. Anyways, these are highly arbitrary sorts of things. And in the Sanquhar Protestation, which is about to be published, they use the word arbitrarians, which I've never heard, but I thought was a good word. Okay, well, James summoned a Scottish Parliament to meet, and it was referred to in just, in this last thing on Andrew Hislop. It was in session in Edinburgh from the 23rd of April through the 22nd of August in 1685. The Duke of Queensberry was the king's commissioner, and he demanded that in the king's name that Parliament should legislate to destroy, quote, "that desperate and fanatical and irreclaimable party who have brought us to the brink of ruin and disgrace, enemies of mankind, wretches of such monstrous principles and practices that past ages never heard, nor those to come will hardly believe." Well, we see whose barbarian practices that ages to come hardly believe. He accused the disaffected of being the executors of the most hellish and barbarous designs that were ever contrived. In a more vulgar tirade, the Chancellor, Perth, declared that, quote, "we have a new sect sprung up among us from the dunghill, the very dregs of the people who killed by pretended inspiration, whose idol is that accursed paper, the Covenant. These monsters bring a public reproach upon the nation in the eyes of all our neighbors abroad. They bring reproach upon our religion and our great plague." There's in the Chancellor's comments, there's one particular slander that these people kill by pretended inspiration. Okay, in other words, they said, "Oh, I have a vision from God to kill so and so and do it." Of course, they didn't. That was just a slander, but in one sense, it was almost as if the persecutors felt they had such, you know, Claverhouse seemed to have such a view of his own work. Having heard their opinions, it won't surprise you that they passed a number of acts declaring it treason to take or own the covenant of 1638 or 1643, ordering the death penalty and confiscation of goods for preachers and hearers at field conventicles, and more along the same lines. Okay, and these acts, I mean, they're pretty much the same. You know, by this point, they could kill people for refusing to take this abjuration oath, so, you know, the death penalty for preachers and hearers at field conventicles is probably a moot, moot point. I mean, they already had the death penalty for refusing to say the oath, so. Another type of parliament met in the fields at the Moss of Black Gannock near Sancor on the 28th of May, 1685. About 200 armed fugitives, led by James Rennick, met and drafted the Protestation and Apologetic Admonitory Declaration of the Contending and Suffering Remnant of the True Presbyterians of the Church of Scotland against the proclaiming James, Duke of York, King of Scotland, England, France, and Ireland, the lawfulness of the present pretended Parliament, and the apparent inlet of Popery, etc. Pretty long title. You can find this on the web by searching for Sancor Protestation. If you want to do that, though, you might want to ask me how to spell Sancor. But it's good that it has a, you know, obscure spelling, or it would be making, you know, you'd find all thousands of documents that are not pertinent. It begins by commenting on the times, recognizing, first of all, that it hath pleased the holy and wise God to exercise the Church of Scotland with wrestling and warfaring under the yoke of cruel oppressors. And not only are the righteous receiving hellish and barbarous treatment, cutting them off in the fields without giving them any time to deliberate upon death, yea, oftentimes without so much as to commit their spirits unto the Lord, but butcherously slaying them without taking notice what they are or what, according to their own laws, to be led against them. Not only that, but everyone's, let's say, civil rights, to use an anachronistic term, are being violated. These arbitrarians have so raged that they have now brought the land to that, oh, poor, miserable, and lamentable slavery, that the freest subject and best gentleman in the kingdom is, by their acts, laws, and proceedings, holden obliged to give an oath super inquirendis before any single soldier or dragoon meeting them upon the way. Okay, well, why has this happened? Lo, again, I'm quoting from this at length here. Lo, all this and much more we have met with is just upon the Lord's part, though most unjust upon man's for our manifold sins and iniquities. Right, so like the God using the Babylonians, right? His ways are just, but that doesn't mean that man's ways are. And in a special manner for our not purging our judicatories and armies when the power was in our hands of men disaffected to the cause and interest of Christ, for our bringing in known malignants to places of power and trust among us, and for inordinate affection unto and lusting after the deceased tyrant, Charles II, and advancing him to the regal throne, even while known by many palpable discoveries, as are to be seen in the causes of God's wrath with the Church of Scotland. I think this is the book by Guthrie. It's not capitalized like a book title, but I presume that's what they're referring to. To retain his heart enmity at the covenanted work of reformation, which sins we desire to confess and mourn for before God, angels, and men, is also our sin in not timorously rejecting the foresaid Charles when he break covenant in all parts of his coronation oath. Howbeit, fearing the lying under such a sin any longer when we were brought to a very small remnant, we did by open declarations disclaim his pretended authority upon many important grounds and reasons, as is to be seen elsewhere, particularly in our declaration published at Lanark, January 12, 1682. They then go on to protest the proclamation of James as king, he being a professed papist and excommunicate person, and a murderer who has shed the blood of the saints of God. Nor is this just their opinion. They go on to cite numerous acts of Parliament, mostly, but also an act of the General Assembly and the Westminster Confession of Faith. But they distance themselves from the sectarians who assert that there can be no legitimate non-Christian king. Okay? Rather, they say that infidelity or difference in religion doth not make void the magistrate's just and legal authority, nor free the people from their due obedience to him. But for Scotland, though, the situation is somewhat unique. They say, howbeit our covenants and acts of Parliament have put a bar upon the admission of any person, if either infidels or of a different religion, while such to govern in Scotland. The practice of our church confirms it in refusing the crown to the late deceased tyrant Charles II until he subscribed such demands as were sent unto him, and especially upon the admission of a known enemy to the true religion to govern. For it could not be but both highly sinful and irrational for us to entrust an enemy to the work and people of God with the interest of both. So, I find that's interesting in case anyone is in doubt about what their grounds for refusing Charles and James authority. They go on to protest against the Parliament and the rise of popery. Then they plead with their sister churches in England and Ireland and further abroad, but particularly England and Ireland. They say, moreover, taking to our serious consideration the low, deplorable, and obscured state of the churches of England and Ireland, and that we are all bound in one covenant and solemnly together, we, in the bowels of Christ, do in like manner hereby admonish you, our brethren, in these our neighboring covenanted lands, that ye remember how far ye have sadly failed in pursuing the ends of the covenants, as we ourselves also have done, which we desire to confess, imploring God's forgiveness to you and us both. How ye have suffered your Lord's enemies to rob you of all your privileges and pleasant things, how ye have given up yourselves to be seduced by complying, lukewarm, and court-flattering brethren, and how ye have passed by, lightly looking upon our bleeding wounds, denying us help, though we have been like to give up the ghost, and what great accession ye have to the giving popery such an open door to enter upon our land again. Remember these things, and consider what the Lord is now calling for at our hand. Break off your sinful ways by repentance, and abandon all lukewarmness and indifferency in the Lord's matters. Give up with your own things, be tender of God's declarative glory, which is lying at the stake. Quit yourselves like Christians and men, and stretch your hands to the helping, strengthening, encouraging, and comforting a poor, wasted, wronged, wounded, reproached, despised, and bleeding remnant, with whom you are in covenant, setting yourselves against all the injuries and affronts done to our blessed Lord Jesus Christ, against the man of sin, the kingdom of Antichrist, and all the limbs and parts thereof. And here, with all sincerity of mind and unfeignedness of resolution, we promise to act unto you the part of covenanted brethren in the Lord to the utmost of our power. Likewise, we do hereby in like manner call unto you, all Protestant Reformed churches, kingdoms, and commonwealths, that you would take to your serious consideration the low and dangerous state of the gospel interest, and advert to the growth and increase of popery in all places, bestirring yourselves timorously against it, lest ye be too late, and lose what much blood and contending may not recover again. Considering the distressed case whereinto we are brought as a share of the true Protestant interest, refreshing us with your help, and withal, as we tender the advantage of Christ's cause, which to own is the Christian's glory, that you engage not yourselves in any quarrel with any person whatsoever, till you know that the quarrel be rightly stated, and that the persons in the judgment of charity are seeking to advance to the kingdom of Christ, lest that ye join yourselves to those who may lead you back to Egypt, and so you provoke the Lord to destroy you in the wilderness. This last part may be a little unclear, but at this time, the church was being slandered, even in places like the Netherlands. I mean, some people were saying that Rennick wasn't properly ordained and those sorts of things. Even people who were otherwise sympathetic. They go on to protest then the misrepresentation of their previous declaration. This is the apologetical declaration from the 8th of October, 1684. And also to disown the rash acts blamed on them, but committed by, say, three or four people. Black McMichael, the duck hunter, being one of them. And this was posted at the Market Cross of Sancor. I have some photos of the Market Cross at Sancor, except for, when I got back, I was looking in one of these books and I was seeing photos of this thing, and that's not what I took pictures of. I stopped at the post office, which said had a little tourist information sign, and asked for directions, and the two women, they're like, one says to the other, "Do you know anything about the Market Cross?" And then all of a sudden a customer walks in. "Oh, Betty, you know, this gentleman here is looking for the Market Cross." "Well, I don't know, but Jim's coming along. He'll be here in a few minutes and he'll know." So meanwhile, I'm standing around the post office and they have this like a little rack for brochures, and I happen to look behind it and there's a thing about the Market Cross at Sancor and the Sancor Declaration. Anyway, so he sent me down to this, I think it's a Baptist church now, but between the church and maybe the manse, there's a wall, and there's this thing that says Market Cross of Sancor. There's nothing really to look at. So I took some pictures of it. And then, like I said, when I got back, I was reading one of these books by Maurice Grant, and I'm looking at the photos in it, and he has pictures of this obelisk, you know, and at this site was the Market Cross of Sancor. I'm like, well, I wish that, you know, I was right there. I wish I'd seen that. So, I don't know. Maybe I have pictures of the real Market Cross. It's hard to say. The obelisk, though, is more impressive than what I've got pictures of. Also, I didn't have this book, Standing Witnesses, you know, which is a guidebook to the to these monuments. Okay, the field killings tapered off abruptly during the summer and fall. There's a number of them where they don't really know the date, you just have to say the year. But other than those, I think there's really only one or two killings later in the year in the fields. But the persecution continued. Many, many prisoners were held around the country, some in very foul conditions. There's one particular prison that's particularly loathsome, so I thought it worth giving you a short description. This is at Dunottar Castle, and apparently, at least I haven't been there, but reading in the Hewison was writing. This was published in 1908. He says there remain intact two stone vaulted stores, one above the other. Neither has a garderobe, toilet. Right. The upper vault, probably a granary with one small window looking on the German Ocean, and one bowl, measures 54 feet 9 inches long by 15 feet 6 inches broad and 12 feet high. It communicates by a chute with a small, wet, vaulted chamber beneath it, measuring 15 feet long, 8 broad, and 9 high, lighted and ventilated through the orifice of a small drain on the floor level, where the prisoners in turn lay down to suck in the air. These are called the Whigs vaults. The Whigs being another name for the Covenanters. The most incredible barbarity with which the wretched Covenanters were treated does not rest merely on the local tradition that refractory inmates were lashed to hooks on the walls and burned with match and otherwise tortured by the soldiers on the guard. The petition of Grisel Cairns and Alison Johnston on behalf of their husbands and the other prisoners is recorded in the minutes of the Privy Council. They refer to the most lamentable condition and to 110 of them in one vault, where there is little or no daylight at all, and contrary to all modesty, men and women promiscuously together, and 40 and 2 more in another room in the same condition, and no person allowed to come near them with meat or drink, but such bread and drink as scarce any rational creature can live upon, and yet at extraordinary rates, being 20 pennies each pint of ale, which is not worth a plaque the pint, and the pock of dust sandy meal is afforded to them at 18 shilling per peck. and not so much as a drink of water allowed to be carried to them, whereby they are not only in a starving condition, but must inevitably incur a plague or other fearful diseases. The council ordered a mitigation of these severities, especially that the prisoners should be confined without throng. So, and in a footnote, Hewison says that Patrick Walker said there were 168 prisoners, some in irons, were driven into one vault. So, interestingly enough, a certain number of those prisoners, which were elderly, were actually driven up there, made to walk from Edinburgh. They were partly emptying out some of the Edinburgh prisons because they knew this uprising was coming, and I think they wanted a place to put the next prisoners. Okay. To clear the prisons, the Privy Council ordered that a number of them be transported to the colonies. Of one such batch, there's an account in the Cloud of Witnesses, and this is actually, it's a different account, but it's of the same thing that I was looking for information on slaves I found. So, this is one Pitlochry transported to New Jersey, 100 prisoners, of whom 24 were women. Okay, and then the editor of Cloud of Witnesses adds, in 1685 there are several acts of council banishing prisoners and handing them over to John Scott, Laird of Pitlochry. Under March 10th, he received a warrant to go to the prisons of Edinburgh, Glasgow, and Stirling and transport 100 of the prisoners to the plantations. He seems also to have gone to Dunottar and to have got about 30 there, among others Patrick Walker, the well-known writer of remarkable passages in the lives of Paden, Cameron, Cargill, etc., or this book we've quoted from before, Six Saints of the Covenant. But he escaped while they were waiting at Leith. The ship sailed September 5th. She had scarcely turned the Land's End when fever broke out, especially among those who'd been confined for so many months in the dark vault at Dunottar. The beef became putrid. The ship twice sprang a leak, and so deadly was the voyage, which lasted for 15 weeks, that their numbers were about 70 less than when they arrived at New Jersey, whither the wind drove them rather than to Jamaica, where the captain had proposed to take them, because the price of slaves was better in Jamaica. Pitlochry himself and his wife being among the dead. On landing, the prisoners seemed to have been left at large, and the inhabitants of a town, not named, a little way up the country, hearing of their circumstances, invited all who were able to travel to come and live with them, and sent horses for such as were not, and entertained them that winter freely and with much kindness. In spring, Pitlochry's son-in-law sought to claim them as his property and sued them before the court of the province. The governor set the case before a jury, who found that the accused had not of their own accord come to the ship and had not bargained with Pitlochry for money or service, and therefore, according to the laws of the country, they were free. Most of the prisoners retired to New England, where they were kindly entertained. So, concludes Wodrow, Pitlochry proposed to be enriched by the prisoners, and yet he and his lady died at sea on the voyage. He sold what remained of the estate to pay the freight, and much of the money remaining was spent upon the lawsuit in New Jersey. Thus it appears to be but a hazardous venture to make merchandise of the suffering people of God. Okay, the trials and hangings of Covenanters continued. The trial of 12 prisoners in August resulted in 3 being hanged, 3 banished. 1, Alexander Shields, was sent to the Bass Rock, and 4 others were sent back to prison. That adds up to 11. I'm not sure what happened. 12. John Nisbet, a veteran of the Continental Wars, Rolyon Green, Drumclog, and Bothwell Bridge. And we mentioned him earlier. His sons were tortured or, you know, threatened. He was captured November 1685. 3 other society men were killed in the skirmish. He was tried at the end of November and hung in the grass market on the 4th of December. Hey, James was not content to let matters lie in Scotland. In November of 1685, he ordered that the Duke of Gordon, the Earl of Seaforth, the Earl of Traquair, and 23 other Popish landlords not be required to take the test. So he actually started promoting Catholicism. The Roman Catholic service at Holyrood was restored. Priests became plentiful in the capital. In January 1686, some apprentices who were said to be in a reforming mood to coerce priests, start a brawl, which ended in some shootings. Even Episcopal curates who spoke out against the rise of popery were disciplined or denounced. In April 1686, James called for another parliament. This time his commissioner was the Earl of Moray, a Catholic. The king claimed he was trying to reward loyal subjects who had supported the crown. He asked for toleration for Catholics who had hazarded life and fortune for his person and crown. He tried to get Parliament to pass an act giving Catholics liberty to worship, but seeing it wouldn't be passed, or at least wouldn't be passed easily, the Chancellor withdrew the act, and Parliament was dissolved. James then changed the membership of the Privy Council and had them pass the act in August of 1686. Well, Rennick continued to preach to the remnant of the faithful. He also wrote letters, and he and other gentlemen were working on a vindication of the society's position. Hewison says, "Nevertheless, dissension crept in among the various bands of wanderers, and much of their spiritual energy was lost in wrangles over points of difference. The legality of Rennick's ordination was one of these. Some maintained that Rennick was an intruded preacher because his ordination had not been approved by a competent court of the Church of Scotland." A bit peculiar, if you ask me. Okay, but even Alexander Payden, right, the prophet of the covenant, who had been sort of on and off in Scotland, he had spent some time in Ireland hiding, he was alienated from Rennick. And he was on his deathbed. He was in a hidey hole. And he called for Rennick so that he could examine him. And let's see. According to Hewison, he had bitterly vowed that he would make the young preacher's name stink above the ground. When death, however, had laid its clutch upon Payden in his earth and hidey hole at 10 Shilling Side in Auchinleck Parish on 28th January 1686, he sent for Rennick to examine him. The wearied youth soon proved to the spent prophet that no defections existed to justify the enmity of that dying witness of the covenant. Payden penitently confessed his regrets that he had listened to slanders which quenched his love and bitterness. Drawing the innocent youth near to be embraced and kissed, the old minister said, "Sir, I find you a faithful servant to your master. Go on in a single dependence upon the Lord, and ye will win honestly through and cleanly off the stage, where many others often hold their head high, will fall and lie in the mire, and make foul hands and garments." Okay, well, that brings us very near the end. I just want to, we'll, God willing, we will finish next week. So, any questions, comments, etc.? Bruce, everyone else is waiting for you to ask something, I'm sure.
Well, I was just thinking about the slaves in America. The argument that's being put forth that where modern melodies were where came the Negro spirituals.
Yeah, I think it's put forth in a very sort of timid manner. But anyways, yeah.
So what I was wondering then is it possible that Ebonics actually has its origin? They would learn English from
these. Well, there you go, maybe.
Rewrite the history.
Well, that was a different sort of question. Anybody else? Okay. Well, let's see. Dan Yost, would you close in prayer?